Welcome to the Daily Stoic Podcast, where each weekday we bring you a meditation inspired by the ancient Stoics, a short passage of ancient wisdom designed to help you find strength and insight here in everyday life. And on Wednesdays, we talk to some of our fellow students of ancient philosophy, well-known and obscure, fascinating and powerful. With them, we discuss the strategies and habits that have helped them become who they are and also to find peace and wisdom in their actual lives. But first, we've got a quick message from one of our sponsors.
There's a lot of things we know would be good for us. Problem is, we don't have time. It's just tougher. I think therapy is like that. We all know that sitting down, talking to someone, really working on our issues will make a difference. So the problem is finding a therapist, driving across town, all of that, right? And that's where Talkspace comes in, today's sponsor. Because by doing everything online, Talkspace has made getting the help you want easier, more accessible, and more affordable. With Talkspace, you can sign up online and get a personalized match with a provider that's right for you, typically within 48 hours. You can have virtual sessions with your licensed therapist from the comfort of your home. And Talkspace is secure and private, using the latest end-to-end grade encryption to store client information and complying with the latest HIPAA regulations. As a listener of this podcast, you'll get $80 off your first month with Talkspace when you go to Talkspace.com/stoic and enter code SPACE80. To match with a licensed therapist today, go to Talkspace.com/stoic and enter promo code SPACE80, that's 80, to get $80 off your first month and show your support for the show. That's Talkspace.com/stoic, promo code SPACE80.
Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business and evolving your passions. We push what technology can do so great ideas can happen now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to now. How are you going to be? Every day, we have a choice. We choose how we're going to act, what we're going to do, what kind of code we're going to look by. As the title of Sheila Hady's novel puts it, the essential question of our days and lives is this: how should a person be? And that's really the central question of Stoic philosophy too, to help you answer that question well. Each of us has the choice to be good or bad, strong or weak, brave or cowardly. Marcus Aurelius's writings, in a sense, are his attempt to answer that incredibly difficult question. You've been made emperor. What kind of emperor will you be? What kind of person will you be? And when he lists his epithets for the self, that's what he was answering. He was saying what a person, what he should be. He was saying upright, modest, straightforward, sane, cooperative, disinterested. And there's so many that we should add to this list: resourceful, resilient, grateful, kind, courageous, still. And certainly all of these words are better than the alternatives: uncooperative, insane, duplicitous, egotistical, crooked. So what will you choose today? How will you be? That is the question. And actually, the rules I have them written here, my epithets for the self. I keep them on my computer, say honest, calm, fair, father, like a parent, brave, and generous. That's how I want to be every day, in every way, in everything that I do. And I never want to forget it, because I'm trying to decide we're becoming who we're going to be, as Cheryl Strayed says. So you might as well be that person today. Hey, it's Ryan. Welcome to another episode of the Daily Stoic Podcast. As you know, Murphy's Law is a law of the universe. What can go wrong will. And anytime I put something out into the world, I am reminded just how much can go wrong. Book launches are always like insanely stressful. So much goes wrong. But this one has been nuts. So I'm signing the copies myself, fulfilling them out of the painted porch on like Lives of the Stoics and Stillness. They mail me like sheets of paper, which I sign, which they then bound into the book. Well, that wasn't possible with this book, with Courage is Calling. And so it's been this, you know, overwhelming, both emotionally, but also logistically sort of scramble to fulfill something like 10,000 signed pre-orders, which seriously, to everyone who ordered, I am beyond honored and I appreciate so much. But I thought I'd give you a little inside look
into how that's gone. The printed copies were supposed to arrive off the printers at the publisher's warehouse like the 27th of August. And then there was a small delay. The pandemic has overloaded most domestic printers, and they arrived on the 1st. Now, I was leaving on the 5th to do we drove across the country. I did a bunch of in-person podcasts in Los Angeles, which there's a bunch of stuff from me coming on. And there's a great YouTube vlog we did about it if you want to check it out. But I needed some of those copies to arrive before I left so I could sign like 1,000 or two before I left. And then the rest would arrive while I was gone, and then I would come back, sign the rest of them. They would all be set up and arranged for me to do that. So there'd be a lot of redundancies and overlap, and then I could sort of steadily do it. Well, that did not happen. Not only did no copies arrive before I left, but only like 10% of the copies that needed to arrive while I was gone arrived. And then I came home and was way behind the eight ball. And the books that were supposed to arrive in the middle of last week didn't arrive. And then the day they were supposed to arrive, they didn't arrive. The publisher hadn't sent them on time, which is very frustrating. Then the shipping company lost them, sent them somewhere else. Then they brought them back. And then, this is all happening yesterday, 4,500 copies of the 10,000 or so arrived at the Painted Porch in a van without means of unloading them. So we had to unload them by hand, then I had to sign them, then we had to package them, and we're not even close to digging our way out of it. It's been a lot. So it's been a lot, and that's what I am dealing with today. But I took a quick break from signing and packaging and overseeing this operation, which a bunch of amazing fans and volunteers have come and helped with. So thank you to them. And my wife and my in-laws and my employees have also been spectacular. But I took a break to have a discussion with one of my favorite people, a person who not only would none of my books be possible without, but The Daily Stoic itself would not exist without. And that is the one and only Steve Hanselman. Steve is my translator on The Daily Stoic. He was my co-writer on Lives of the Stoics. And he's also my book agent. He's been a bookseller, a publisher, and a literary agent for like 30 years. He's a graduate of Harvard Divinity School. He has a master's degree and studied quite a bit in the philosophy department. He's worked with a bunch of amazing authors, including the one and only Tim Ferriss, who is the source of our connection. But I wanted to talk to Steve because Steve knows about as much about Stoicism as anyone I have ever met. And I wanted to talk about the virtue of courage because whether you pick up the book or not, courage is important. It's desperately lacking in today's world. And I wanted to talk about courage. I wanted to talk about what it meant to the Stoics. I also wanted to give you kind of an inside look into who I am, how other people see me, what I am like as a client, what I'm like as a writer, what I'm like as an author, working with a publisher, and just some of the logistics of like the big leaps and some of the backstory behind the big scary leaps that I took in my life, whether it was leaving marketing to write my first book, whether it was publishing my first controversial book, leaving marketing behind to write my first philosophy book, and then the decision to take on this sort of big, overwhelming and scary series, the Four Virtue series that I'm working on now, and just some of the stress and tension that has been sort of getting this book out into the world over the last several weeks. And Steve felt like an amazing person to talk to about it. I love Steve. He's a great dude. I think you'll get a sense of our affection and collaborative relationship in this interview. So thank you to Steve. And remember, Courage is Calling, Fortune Favors the Brave is now available everywhere. You can go to your local bookstore and pick it up. You can come to the Painted Porch and pick it up. We are still offering the pre-order bonuses. We've extended it to the end of this week. So you can get that at dailystoic.com/pre-order. But you can also get Audible. You can get eBooks. You can get whatever you want from wherever you want it. But I would very much like you to support the new book, Courage is Calling, Fortune Favors the Brave. And in the meantime, enjoy this conversation with Steven Hanselman and myself on the topic of the four virtues and the most important of the four virtues, courage. You know what I was thinking about? What do you remember about the first time we met? Because it occurred to me that it was almost 10 years ago exactly that we went out with my first book.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the first time in person, we were in a room together at Tim Ferriss's marketing summit out in Napa. And we actually both spoke on the dais that day, but we didn't get to talk to each other personally.
Right.
And it was after that you followed up with me and sent me Trust Me, I'm Lying, which you'd already been through a couple of drafts on before I even saw it.
So. Yeah, I was basically done. I had been sleeping on the draft. I hadn't told anyone I was working on it. And then you didn't tell me that you were interested in Stoicism until, like, I feel like it was like after The Obstacle Is the Way came out.
Yeah, it's funny because it was like a conversation that I had been having with Tim, who is also, you know, very interested in the Stoics. And of course, he was very focused on Seneca. And you sort of came in through Marcus Aurelius. My own story with Stoicism went way back. I actually had a professor in college, Delbert Weins, who did his dissertation on Musonius Rufus.
Oh, really?
I first heard about them then, but, you know, was sort of only reading secondary sources. And it wasn't until I got into graduate school that I started reading Epictetus, which was basically, I found a Thomas Wentworth Higginson translation. And that's sort of when I first started reading the Stoics directly.
Interesting. Yeah, Wentworth Higginson is fascinating. And it's sort of strange that he's not a better known American hero. I mean, some people know who Robert Shaw is. There's a monument to him in Boston. He's also the subject of the movie Glory. But if you want to talk about putting Stoicism into practice and the four virtues, there you have a guy who translates Epictetus. I believe he's the champion and friend of Emily Dickinson.
That's correct. And then he was also very involved in the suffragette movement.
So. Right. And then if that weren't sort of Stoicism enough, then he leads a black regiment in the Civil War, which was, you know, to fight in the Civil War, to fight on the right side of it was, you know, sort of a dicey enough proposition. But I mean, they buried Robert Shaw in a ditch when he was killed because it was considered to be, you know, sort of the ultimate race transgression to lead black soldiers as a white person at that time.
Yeah. Well, there's no doubt that Higginson really found such strength, you know, from his reading of the Stoics, and he showed it in so many aspects of his life.
I'm just Googling this, Wentworth Higginson. I wonder if there's any statues of him. I imagine that there are not.
I'm not sure. I think he's buried in upstate New York. I'm not even sure what's there.
Yeah, there's a small grave. He died in 1911. Wow.
Yeah. Fascinating guy.
I think so. I mean, and to me, that's what I think I fell in love with as far as the Stoics. So, although, again, I didn't hear from about him until much, much later. But I like the idea of the philosopher as the man or woman in the arena, right? And I think that's what's so interesting to me about the Stoics is that they weren't these kind of like passive figures. They weren't theoretical figures. They weren't talking about the action as it was happening, but actually sort of were in the action as it was happening and pushing the envelope as far as what that action was.
Yeah. I mean, it's, I know in the new book, you quote William James, but I think there's this sense in all the great Stoics, you know, who are exemplars, you know, not only in their own time, but to us still today, but they're all using the system, the precepts, the powerful ideas to kind of, as William James put it, make our nervous system our ally instead of our enemy. You know, it's like this constant work, not for some schoolroom practice, but to take it out into the arena and show what a difference it can make.
Yeah, that's right. And you know, we kind of almost brush over some of the contributions of the Stoics, not just someone like Higginson, but, you know, it's like almost all the Stoics that we profiled in Lives of the Stoics had some form of military service, some form of public service, were exiled. Like, we almost just take for granted that the maybe it's that the ancient world was so chaotic and so much was happening that we just, like, sort of assume, like, of course they were there, or of course this happened. But it is interesting just to think about how active these people were.
Absolutely. I mean, it was Zeno's dictum from the beginning that, you know, you have to participate in public life unless you're unable.
Yeah. So. Right. No, the people think the difference between the Epicureans and the Stoics was the sort of, you know, pursuit of pleasure. And in fact, the Seneca says, actually, we're not that much in disagreement there. You know, sort of pleasure in moderation is fine. It's that the Epicureans retreat to the garden or to the, you know, I think the modern equivalent would be like the academy or some, so, you know, pursuit. They flee to the sort of individualistic world, and the Stoics sort of believe quite deeply in our collective obligations. And unless something actively prevents that sort of overwhelming corruption or dysfunction or injury or something like that, you are obligated to contribute to the polis.
Absolutely.
So let me ask you. So we connected on that first at that meeting, and then I came to you with the book, and then I was thinking about selling it recently because I was in California and I was visiting my grandfather's grave, who I remember I had flown like directly from the funeral to sell that book. But I'm curious, where did you think my trajectory would go? Because I remember I was asking Nikki, my editor on most of my books, like sort of what she thought when I started the first Stoic book. And she was saying something like, well, we just hoped you'd get it out of your system and then go back to marketing books. Is that the direction you thought I would go as a client?
Not at all. In fact, you know, when Julie and I talked about it, and we loved, Trust Me, I'm Lying. And we knew that was sort of, it was sort of this deep philosophical lesson you had learned from practicing, you know, these dark arts of media manipulation. But we knew from following your blogging and your writing that, you know, popular philosophy was much more your gift, you know, translating the ideas in a way that people can use in their lives. So, you know, I told Julie, I said, we're going to get this book in the right hands, but, you know, I really want to see him, you know, writing about philosophy. Of course, you know, I was a double major in history and philosophy in college, and I went through divinity school at Harvard, doing about half my work in the philosophy department. So, you know, I've always had a bias for writers who have that kind of interest and focus. And, you know, I at the time, I just knew that there was nobody really doing what you could do on a popular level. So it was my hope that that's where you would go, and you did.
That's interesting, because I've had this thing a bunch of times in my life and career where, like, I kind of had some vague sense of what might be possible, but weirdly sort of other people saw it more excitedly than I did. Like, I kind of thought dropping out of college would work, or I kind of thought, you know, the books would work. But it has been weird that certain people have seen it better than me. I'm not sure what that says or what that means, but it's always been surprising to me.
Well, you know, you're a very clear writer, and you're a very prolific writer, and you've been putting it out there for longer than the books have been out there. So, you know, those who follow you know. So,
yeah, that was the funny thing when Trust Me, I'm Lying came out. A lot of people were like, "Well, what is this?" Right? They were like, "I thought you write about philosophy." And then when Trust Me, I'm Lying did well, or it was sort of this big splash. You know, then when the philosophy books came out, people were like, what is this? And now that's the question I get asked the most. People go like, well, how did you transition from marketing to philosophy? And it's weirdly the other way around.
Yeah, it is, for sure.
So the other juncture point for you and I was the decision to go with, you know, go away from marketing to the philosophy books. And I remember I'd already written the proposal. I remember it was called Turning the Obstacle Upside Down or something like that. It wasn't the obstacle is the way yet. But I remember you, I didn't do any meetings for it, but you had gone out with it when I was in Brazil or something. I was doing a talk in Brazil. And I remember being in a hotel room and going back and forth over email about it. But I think now that the books have done very well, people see that as like a very obvious transition. And sometimes really cynical or, you know, people who are not fans go like, oh, he obviously did this for money. But that wasn't the case at the time. I remember it being a very hard sell.
Yeah. Yeah. I think there was a lot of convincing and we certainly were paid less for it.
A lot less, right?
Yeah. Yeah. So, but you know, I always, you know, I'm a literary agent by day and I always tell my clients that, you know, if we're in the right hands, we're with the right editor, we do the book in the right way, you know, the book is going to earn. Eventually it's going to earn its way. And, so yeah, I mean, we were definitely swallowing a loss there at the beginning, but
it was less than half, I remember.
Far less than half, but you know, it's turned out to be the best-selling book. So there you go.
No, I think, and to me, there's a couple lessons in that at least that I've taken, which is number one, having people often think like you have to be all in on whatever you're doing. But the fact that I still had a job meant that I didn't care that much, right? Like I could very easily take the massive step backwards because like I didn't need it to feed my family or something, right? It was all sort of, at that point, the writing income was all extra income in my life. I had my own business. I had a job. So to me, that was one thing I took out of it. Two, if we talk about ego as the enemy, the idea that like what you get paid is not reflexive of your worth. And you if you really believe in something, if you really know, it doesn't really matter what people think or what people value it as. What matters is sort of what it becomes in the long run. But then I think the other thing that this ties more into the idea of courage. And of course, this is not the same courage as running into a burning building. But I have found, because I've done lots of ghostwriting projects and worked with all different types of people over the years, which is that almost no agent or author is willing to do that. You were saying like, hey, if the book is good, it'll earn. I find that most agents and most writers, all they care about is the advance. So they're essentially not willing to bet on themselves. The Obstacle is the Way was a big bet. I took half the money up front that I would normally get. But in the long term, it earned out. And it's actually better for tax purposes to get paid out over a long period of time. But I find people aren't willing to do that. Either they don't believe in the project, they don't believe in themselves, or they don't believe in a long-term future enough, like the idea of the marshmallow test, to be willing to take less guaranteed for a higher, you know, upside down the road.
Yeah. And I, you know, even accounting aside, I mean, it kind of comes down to, you know, the basic insight of the Stoics and, you know, what we value and the choices that we make, right? Mm-hmm. It's what's important is the soundness of your aim. And, you know, your perseverance in sticking to it. Happiness is never going to be found in things, money, desire for things or money. That's a dead end, you know. If you want to get on the right road and go somewhere, you have to have the right aim and you have to stick to it. And, you know, that one book became a series. And now look at us today. We're launching a whole new series.
When, what's the alternative, right? Writing books that you don't actually want to write because the advances are better? And I know when you say that, people are like, oh, obviously not. But that's what the vast majority of people do, not just in publishing, but in literally all professional fields. Most people don't do what they want. They do what the market wants the most, or they do what is the most immediately viable at the expense, not just of like their happiness, but also their like credibility and dignity as a human being.
Correct. Yep.
It's hard though. There was certainly a part of me that was like, maybe they're not valuing it at this level because it's a bad idea. Right. So I think that's the hard part is that you know, it's easy to go where lots of people are,
yeah,
right? Or you know, where the market is.
Yeah, it's true. But and professionally too, though, you know, this happens in publishing a lot because, you know, publishers, you know, they every time they acquire a book, they have to give examples of similar books and they have to give forecasts of sales. And they even go as far as doing a profit and loss statement. And, you know, once an author has been overpaid and had a book that doesn't perform, it in a way, it almost dooms an author's career with a publisher. I mean, good editors, good publishing teams will, you know, allow an author to course correct. But often you see the one-hit wonder where, you know, the publisher got really excited in the author's pitch and belief and paid a lot of money, and they never got published again when the book didn't work.
I've talked a lot about my morning routine here. One of the things I do every morning after I get up is I take a bunch of vitamins that my doctor recommended after some blood tests. I take a vitamin C, a zinc, a omega-3, and I take a couple others who I'm forgetting, but I definitely know whose vitamins I take. And they actually happen to be today's sponsor, and I've been taking them long before Thorne sponsored today's episode. Thorne takes a personalized, innovative, and scientific approach to health and wellness with all their supplements, and they've teamed up with leading medical professionals to bring out highly effective nutritional supplements. Because I'm a runner, I'm always trying to take care of my joints. And with Thorne, I never have to question what's in each supplement. Give your body what it really needs with Thorne. Go to thorne.fit/dailystoic and use code dailystoic for 10% off your first order. That's thorne.fit/dailystoic and use code dailystoic for 10% off your order. thorne.fit/dailystoic. Use code dailystoic. And note, these statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. The Daily Stoic is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. One of the cool things about podcasts is that you can multitask while you're listening, but depending on what you're doing right now, like for instance, if you're not in some kind of moving vehicle, there's something else you could be doing. You could be getting an auto quote from Progressive Insurance. It's easy and you could save money by doing it right from your phone. Drivers who save by switching to Progressive save nearly $700 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Discounts for having multiple vehicles on your policy, being a homeowner, and more. So just like your favorite podcast, Progressive will be with you 24/7, 365 days a year, so you're protected no matter what. Multitask right now. Quote your car insurance at progressive.com to join over 29 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $698 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations. To sort of show people how it works behind the scenes, we kind of went through that a little bit with Conspiracy too, right? Because it was this sort of splashy of the moment book. And I don't think we were overpaid for it. And I actually think probably if you looked at the math, it would have been, I still think we were underpaid, but it was interesting to watch that book sort of be very critically reviewed and be sort of develop this cult audience, but not, you know, it didn't sell like Bad Blood or something. It didn't blow the doors off. And so I remember it being as the launch of Stillness was getting prepped, I remember there being a bit of a headwind because people had trouble. They wanted to then use Conspiracy as a baseline, and I wanted to sort of go, no, that was a risk. That's like outside the sample here. But I think people are often worried about taking risks or doing outside the box stuff because they know it will cost them in terms of people's expectations and where they classify them and where they rank them and all of that.
Yeah. Well, I think one of the things about that book, I mean, you say it felt of the moment, but, you know, I think oddly, in a way, it's going to end up being one of those books that people understand defined an era mm-hmm. in a way that we couldn't see at the time, you know, kind of like the way The Big Short defined, you know, that whole era and the kind of, you know, mindless risk taking and you know, stuff that was going down and accept it as normal at the time, you know.
But what I really liked about that book was actually a really sort of the obstacles the way part of it was that because that it didn't, you know, all my books up till that point had sort of sold faster than the book before. And that was the first one that didn't. And it was actually really helpful and freeing because I knew it was very good. And people that I respected said that it was very good. And it also resonated with an audience that perhaps my other books hadn't resonated with. And it was actually really helpful for me to completely decouple the idea of quality and sales, right? And then, so weirdly, when Stillness is the Key came out and sold the most that any of my books had sold and debuted at number one, it was actually helpful because those things were decoupled, right? Still, they were just too, it's not that they were, that I didn't care about either. They were just two unrelated facts. It was, right. I had written the book that I was most proud of to that point, and it had sold the best, as opposed to this sold the best because it is the best, or, you know, whatever other relation you want to put between those facts.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, at this point now, what are we on, book number 11?
I don't know. Is it 11 or 12? Do you count the journal? Do you count the different editions?
Exactly.
I don't know.
But, you know, you've definitely, at this point, there are genres of Ryan Holiday. And they're all working in a little bit different ways. So,
what does a courageous author look like to you? Like, when if you think about that attribute as far as like a person in a creative field, what is that? What's that criteria for you?
To me, it's the person who's actually done the work, who's, you know, gone out, researched, done the reading, you know, thought long and hard about, you know, their point of view, and, you know, will not, in the process of producing a book, will not, you know, do injustice to either, you know, of those two things.
Sure.
And, you know, it's often in trade publishing, there are a lot of pressures.
Yeah.
To, you know, kind of suppress the work that you've done or to smooth off, you know, your point of view. But, you know, I think both those things have to be in place. And the authors who are staunchest in sticking by that and seeing it through to the end, I think do the best. They break through because it stands out.
Well, and don't you think part of breaking through is also sort of breaking through into new ground or open territory? Like, what I think is so interesting is now I get them all. Like, lots of books are being published about Stoicism, and I'm not questioning those people's commitment or interest to the philosophy. I think it's wonderful, but I do suspect that there are a set of motivations going on, both from the publisher and from the writer, which is essentially, this is a lucrative market, right? Like that I think sometimes the people are going, you know, Ryan doesn't have any credentials. What does he know? I'm smarter. I'm better. I will sell. And because of those things, I will obviously be much more successful in this market because I have those markers. But really what they are doing is walking into a much safer space because there is a defined market. There is an understanding from the retailers and from the algorithm and all of that, that people are interested in this.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, publishers like to believe that they can look around the corner and see the next thing, but, you know, more often than not, they're more trying to adapt what's coming in to something they already know is a success. You know, it's funny. I'll just never forget, you know, when I went out with Tim Ferriss the first time with a 4-hour work week, which was not called that at the time.
Right. It was like drug dealer or something.
We were calling it lifestyle hustling. But it was based on a course that he jokingly titled at Princeton, Drug Dealing for Fun and Profit. But, you know, all the ideas in that book, again, this gets back to, you know, have you done the work? You know, do you have a point of view? All the ideas in that book at the time just sounded a little bit nutty to publishers. Like, there was nothing to compare it to. Like, the idea of remote working and, you know, geo-arbitrage and mini-retirements and, you know, using the Pareto principle to, you know, to optimize you know, productivity. Like all these things were like, you know, people were like, what? But, you know, fast forward today and look, we just like, because of the pandemic, which nobody saw coming, we're like in the greatest productivity period in American history the last couple of years. And it all happened when people were basically free to work remotely.
Yeah.
So it's funny. I was just talking to Tim the other day. I was like, you know, it's like, you know, everyone thought it was crazy at the beginning, and now the whole world is living this life.
Yeah. And, you know, it's funny. I have a chapter in the Courage book about, based on the Henry Miller quote, where he says, all growth is a leap in the dark, a spontaneous, unpremeditated act without the benefit of experience. And that's really, I think, the thing about publishing or making anything is that the real big hits, the things that work, or that Peter Thiel, as we were talking about him, that talks about give you a monopoly, is in the dark spaces, the space where there is no one, where it hasn't been proven yet. And I think people really struggle with that, though, because they want, as you're leaving, or as you're trying to if you're leaving your old life, as you're, you know, thinking about quitting your job or whatever it is to do this new thing, you want some guarantee or reassurance that like it's going to work out, that there's some like minimum level of success you can count on. But that sort of floor is also establishes some sort of ceiling. And so you really do have to sort of carve out a new space. And I feel like all of my books have that. That's something I think about when I do them, which is like, has anyone done anything similar to this? And if so, that's not what I'm interested in doing. I want to do a totally new way of thinking about this topic or this idea or this space. I want to make something that doesn't exist.
No, and I think you brought that into this new series. I mean, you know, I think, you know, a lot of people are aware of the four cardinal virtues. You know, many aren't, but, you know, they're so central, or have been central, probably not, they're missing completely in current culture, but they've been so central to, you know, certainly to Western civilization. But, you know, the idea that you started with courage, I think for those who are in the know, it's going to surprise them that you're starting with courage.
Why do you think that is?
Well, it's, you know, generally when you see all the lists of the virtues, it's not the first one, you know, that you see. But, you know, I like the way you talk about it in the book, about it, you know, really being the backbone, you know, of the virtues. And, you know, we can choose to do the appropriate thing, but unless we stick to it and follow through, you know, which is what courage is all about, what's the point? So,
yeah. Do you remember when I came to you with the idea? I was just doing a video about it, but I was just thinking about like the sort of the origin story of the book. I was wondering what I remember,
and this is what it's like, you know, working with you, is you're always kind of digging it all out in advance. Like, you know, you were doing a lot of writing about the virtues, and you know, you had the medallion, and you know, you're really like trying to highlight it. And you know, it's important because a lot of people will come into Stoicism and they're just thinking about, you know,
productivity or whatever.
Yeah, and being tough and all of that. But you know, often the kind of stuff you see and hear out there and the memes, it's just like completely devoid of the virtues, you know. And I know that's been important to you, you know, from the beginning. So, you know, I could see you were working toward it. But when you told me, I was so excited. I was like, yes. So
yeah, I remember I was walking in Bastrop State Park with the kids. This is right as, for people who don't understand how publishing works, is like you finish the book and then there's all the other stuff like the editing and then the publishing. And there's like a bunch of stuff, but there's kind of this like fallow period, like about 3 months before a book comes out, where sort of you can't do anything to the book that's coming out. But there's this looming date as to when it is coming out. And you kind of have this sort of nervous, weird energy. It's like that Shakespeare line about between decision and the deed, there's this sort of vague phantasma. It's I hate that period, and I usually try to channel that energy into writing the next proposal.
Yeah. Well, it's sort of become your flywheel. I mean, this has been the rhythm now for many years.
So. Yeah. Yeah. I imagine it's a tad exhausting. Certainly my wife has told me it's exhausting.
Yeah,
I can't do it any other way.
I'm quite sure of that.
Yeah. So what I remember is I had the idea for Courage, and then I don't remember how Courage, I originally just thought Courage, and I don't remember if it was you or if it was Niels. My wife says it was her, which probably means it was, but I don't remember how that became the series, but I think that came pretty quickly.
Yeah. So, I think it was a great choice, particularly for the time that we're living in, right? You don't see a lot of courage and bravery, a lot of, frank talk in the face of some of the crazy stuff that's going on. And of course, being in a pandemic and on lockdown, oftentimes the only place that frank talk can happen is in social media, which is, a complete ruin these days. So,
right. Yeah. And there was, to me, I think what I liked about it was the idea of doing a series was Obstacle, Ego, and Stillness had sort of accidentally become a trilogy. But although it looks like a trilogy afterwards, there wasn't actually the big sort of swing challenge of like, well, what's the series going to be and what's the arc and what do I want to include and what do I not want to include? It was much more ad hoc. And I do think I was attracted to the idea of like the sort of four-dimensional chess of like, well, how do all these ideas relate to each other? What goes in each book? And like, because there's definitely chapters, like there's a chapter on ego in Ego versus Confidence and Stillness that I wish was in Ego. And there's chapters in Obstacle that I wish were probably in Stillness and vice versa. On this one, to really like have to think about four books simultaneously in a relatively short runway was just like ambitiously attractive to me.
Well, I think, it makes sense. And, people are going to understand, with this series that, basically the Stoics believe that, happiness can only be found in virtue, nowhere else. All the Stoics agreed on this. The happy life is to be found in the pursuit of virtue, which they called arete, human excellence, these sort of forms of knowledge that guide us in everything that we think and do. The Stoics believe that virtue was about the integrity of the self, right? Arius Didymus said that virtue is a disposition of the soul in harmony with itself concerning the whole of one's life. And, I think these four books are really going to map that out for people. Virtue, the Stoics thought, was our operating system as human beings. It's what we have to use, the program we're supposed to be following to make our way through the world.
The less your business spends, the more margin you keep. I talk about that in Growth Hacker Marketing. But today, everything costs more. So smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, HR into one proven platform, helping you reduce IT costs, maintenance costs, and manual errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move to NetSuite. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/stoic. That's netsuite.com/stoic.
Do you ever wonder where all your money went? Like every single time you look at your bank account? Honestly, it's probably all those subscriptions. I felt that way too, until I got Rocket Money. Rocket Money helped me see all the subscriptions I'm paying for, and it was eye-opening. Between streaming services, fitness apps, delivery services, it all adds up so quickly. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year, with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
Well, because there's no situation in which one or more of the four virtues is not called upon.
Exactly.
It's funny, though. I remember I gave a talk, so this would have been right as Daily Stoic was coming out. I gave a talk at StoicCon in New York City, and I think you did too, if I'm remembering correctly, but or maybe that was the next one. But I remember I gave a talk and I said something like, and this is a thing, I just gave a talk last week or this week, and I just said the same thing. But I, you know, I said to the Stoics, and this is what to me the idea of the obstacle is the way is not that every bad situation is positive. It's that there's no situation so bad, so undesirable, so unexpected that one of the virtues is not possible. It's not an opportunity. All situations remain an opportunity to practice virtue. That's what the opportunity is. But I remember saying in the talk, like, virtue can feel like a very loaded word to people because it has a sort of a Christian sort of sin connotation that can just mean a lot of things that it doesn't necessarily mean. And so I remember saying this, you know, let's put virtue aside and call it excellence. And I remember some people got upset. I remember getting an email about it or some comments about it, that was somehow sort of taking an ancient philosophy and making it too much about success or literature or too much sort of a modern context. But to me, that's actually restoring virtue to its proper context, because virtue, as you said, is arete, which means excellence. It's just that excellence has both a moral and a worldly component, right? Like excellence, if you're just good at a craft, but it's done immorally, that's not excellence. But also, if you're just moral, but you can't apply it in the world, you have no sort of skill or expertise, that's also sort of emptiness. So to me, I think if we can think of virtue as human excellence, sort of flourishing as a person in the highest form that we are capable of being, the virtue or virtues becomes a lot more accessible.
Absolutely. And I like the point that you hit on about, you know, sin versus, you know, basically missing the mark. I mean, it's the same word in the New Testament or for the Stoics, hamartia. But, you know, for the Stoics, there is no original sin, you know. Hamartia is just missing the mark. It's like we were aiming for something, we didn't get it. You know, we're trying to avoid something, it hit us anyway.
We didn't want to do something, we did it anyway, even though right. We know it was bad.
So, you know, they believe that, you know, contrary to this, any notion of original sin or corruption, that we're only in bad environments. And actually, we have something positive to celebrate. All of us have these great inborn resources. They believe the seeds of virtue are in each and every person. Like, it's in there. But just because it's in there doesn't mean you're going to make use of it or get benefit from it, make progress in your life as a human being. You have to actually engage the disciplines. They are both an aim and a practice. You know, there's something we're directing our life toward, but that we have to practice in each and everything that we choose to do.
And don't you think, to me, the other part of removing it from this sort of sin context is it's not that falling short or doing a bad thing or sort of not being as good as you can be. It's not that God will be angry at you and that you will go to hell after you die. To the Stoics, it's that to live without arete, to sort of not fulfill your potential, to continually miss the mark, to not even try to hit the mark, is to live in hell. Like that your life is hell. So to me, it's a much more self-interested, logical argument for being good. And I think you see this with all the Stoics, but particularly the Stoics who had sort of close proximity to power, whether it's Nero or Marius or Caesar. The Stoic argument was like,
it sucks to be these people. There's not some cosmic karma that's going to punish them in the afterlife. The Stoics were like, it's horrible to be this person. They are not winning. That's why Marcus Aurelius says the best revenge is to not be like that.
Yeah, I mean, the only evil that we can do is to abandon our pursuit of virtue, to corrupt our own character. So the focus is always back to our choices. What are we putting value on? What are we choosing? How are we responding, you know, to the situations in front of us? And, you know, when you engage, when as you were saying before, when your assumption is that bad things are going to happen, trouble is always going to come. As Seneca says, you know, the wise man accustoms himself to coming trouble, right? Mm-hmm. You lighten the evils of life by long endurance, by thinking about them, right? The wise man knows that everything is in store for them. So, you know, but I think, you know, where one of the things that you really bring out to the fore, and I think it's going to be a theme in all the books, but in Courage, is for the Stoics, virtue, the practice of virtue, all the virtues were interrelated and of a whole, right?
Sure.
But for them, our self-interest and our self-concern always had to remain connected to the interests and concerns of others. Like when you think about doing the right thing and right actions, one of the first measures to bring up to see whether you're really practicing the justice, the virtue you proclaim, is whether it's just, right?
Sure.
And, you know, Cicero talks about that in Moral Duties, Deo Fices. He's like, you know, we can't trust anyone who's gained a reputation for courage by treachery and cunning. You know, it has to be morally right. You know, on moral ends, he says the same thing. You know, it has to be about what's right.
Yeah, this is for people who obviously haven't read the book yet. This is the third part of the book. Is so the first part of the book is about the battle with fear. The second part is about being courageous. But the third part is when we apply this courage to something other than our own self-interest. So I talk, for instance, about Michael Jordan, the decision to leave basketball to play baseball. This is immensely courageous. He's walking away from millions of dollars. He has the courage to be bad in front of millions of people. It's a huge career risk. He's walking away from his prime years. But we contrast that with, say, someone like Maya Moore, who walks away from equal heights in her sport in the WNBA, to free a man from who's wrongly convicted from prison. It's a higher form of courage. And so I think, yeah, courage is not being willing to jump out of an airplane because you don't feel fear. Courage would be, you know, parachuting behind enemy lines at Normandy, or that's what heroism would be. So I think, yeah, the Stoic conception, it's very easy to think of Stoicism as an individualistic philosophy, which it is, because the individual is all that we control. But the sort of the paradox is the Stoic controls the individual so as to make the best or the greatest contribution to the collective.
To the whole, yeah. You know, this is, so the Stoics were really, they stood apart from Aristotle's school, you know, the Peripatetics. You know, who I think had ideas that kind of, you know, resonate more with our current culture. You know, they felt that, you know, anger, for example, could be like the whetstone of courage. But the Stoics were like, no way. You know, Marcus is like, you feel a fit of rage coming on? You know, that's not right. You know, it's more human to be gentle and civil. And therefore, he even says it's a manlier thing than, you know, having anger. But, you know, today, a lot of people excuse themselves from the virtues because they're angry. Or as you say in the first part of this book, they have fear. Or they just want to sit around and complain about what's made the situation this way, or blame whoever they think, you know, is at fault. All of those things, anger, fear, complaint, blame, they're all excuses to inaction, right? To avoiding the constructive things that we should be doing, the proper choices we should be making.
Well, I've thought about that a lot during the pandemic because, you know, we've taken it very seriously in our house, partly because my wife has always had lung issues, but partly because I have the privilege, the ability to not have to do things that certain people have to do under ordinary circumstances. But anyways, I've taken the pandemic very seriously and I've talked about it. And it's been interesting. You hear people, and actually Derek Thompson for The Atlantic, who's great, I've loved his stuff. In the early days, he called this pandemic stoicism, this sort of toxic masculine approach to the pandemic, which is like, I'm not afraid of a virus. I'm not a pussy. I'm not going to wear a mask. Or, you know, then later the sort of vaccine hesitancy. I think it's so easy to miss what courage is about. Courage is not about not being afraid of something. It can be, but you have to do exactly what you said, which is think about how this plays out for people other than just yourself. So if you say, I don't care about a virus, I'm not scared of it, that's great if the virus only affected you. But if by not being afraid of the virus, you then, let's say, first off, just make other people uncomfortable, right? Like you just walk into a store and you make this poor cashier uncomfortable, that's already damaging the collective whole. Like part of mass is signaling in the sense that we're all saying, hey, don't worry as much about me. We're all on the same team. But if by not being afraid of the virus, by not worrying about, by saying you don't care about your health, you are actively endangering other people's health, right? They're saying with the Delta virus that the average person infects something like 7 to 10 other people. So by having a cavalier, quote unquote, courageous attitude about it, actively harms the collective whole. Then it's not just not courageous, it's actively violating the core Stoic virtue. First off, it's violating wisdom and self-control and all that, but it's definitely violating the virtue of justice. So how our courage connects to and impacts other people is not just a core part of it, it's the whole damn point.
Exactly. And you know what the Stoics would say about a person behaving that way is that they're cowardly. It's cowardice. They're proclaiming something terrible, you know, their liberty for masking, right? For yes. Not masking. They're confusing it with what's really terrible, you know, namely their lack of concern for others.
No, that's totally right. And honestly, they have found that like at the core of it for a lot of people is like deep down a fear of needles, but which I think is a wonderful irony. But I think you go to the vaccine, right? I wrote this piece. I'm not sure where it'll get published yet, but I've been thinking a lot about it because it's something I was really struggling with. There is seemingly, or at least on the surface, a certain amount of courage. Like let's say, you know, there's now some vaccine mandates and a significant percentage of like nurses and different people in different professions have said, I'll lose my job rather than you tell me what to do. There's people in the NFL that have lost their job. There's teachers that have lost their jobs. A whole bunch of people have said like, I will lose my job over this principle. Now that might seem like courage, right? Because, and ironically, that is the kind of courage that we desperately need more of as a society. We need more people who are willing to put, you know, principle over professional interests, right? Or who are willing to go to the mattresses on what they believe. But this is where you have to look at how the other virtues interrelate with each other, because what is your courage? What is the principle ultimately at stake here? You're resisting, you're proclaiming your freedom to infect yourself and therefore very likely other people, to say nothing of the costs on the medical system and the economy and all of that. You're fighting for the principle to actively harm other people. That's where these virtues come together. Like, can you sacrifice your own preferences? Can you take a risk? There is a certain amount of uncertainty to it, because ultimately you care about other people and not just yourself. That's the whole thing.
Yeah. Well, you know, you write about this in the book too, you know, the you know, being able to speak frankly, you know, to people and to let them know, you know, where the line is. I mean, you've experienced this in your own bookstore, right?
Mm-hmm.
with people who don't want to come in and obey the mandate.
Do you ever think that I'm depriving myself of an audience, or that I am thinking like, do you ever see stuff that I write or say and think that I should, I don't want to stay in my lane, but do you think that I am potentially not reaching people who I could reach with Stoicism by doing it? Or do you think it's the right call?
I think it's the right call. I mean, you know, look, obviously, this sort of goes back to, you know, the conversation about point of view and, you know, talking about when Tim was first launching. I mean, if what you have to say polarizes people, good, because right. out of that comes conversation, right? And those who don't want to participate in a conversation, they're eventually just going to drift away anyway, right? They're going to go pull together with like-minded people and you know, yell and complain and blame, you know, others. But, you know, there's nothing productive in that. You know, you're trying to build an audience of people who want to engage the conversation and want to pay it forward. So
that's true. But, you know, there's that Michael Jordan line that he's sort of pilloried for. But he goes like, Republicans buy sneakers, too. It's a tricky thing. I think when, you know, people go like, you know, most people are on the, you know, say, like the vaccine bandwagon or something. But it's like, you know, like 30% of the population is not. That's a large, that's like, if you said, hey, Ryan, if you do this, your book sales are going to decrease, you're risking pissing off 30% of the audience. I see why people don't do it.
I mean, in theory, but, you know, in practice, what do we see? You know, the audience is growing. The only fallout I see, and you see, of course, every day, is you get these hatchet job reviews that get posted on Amazon, or, you know, people trashing up your social media feeds. So.
Yeah, no, I think that is a thing. The term they have for it these days is audience capture. So what happens is someone, you know, you think you're building or acquiring the audience, but actually Seneca talks a lot about this as far as money or profession, but actually the audience or the platform or the success is capturing you. And so you'd think you'd have more freedom when you become successful, when you have, you know, followers or fans or an audience. But actually you become more conservative, more constrained, because now you're afraid of risking them. And this is why people don't, you know, say or do unorthodox things. They are worried about the costs. And ironically, the more successful and bigger you get, the more quantifiable and large those costs can be. You know, what's his name? Daryl Morey, you know, sort of tweets out some controversial comments about communist China like two seasons ago in the NBA. The entire salary cap of the NBA is reduced as a result of the direct economic consequences of that decision.
No, it's true.
It's tough though. I think, so you go, oh, it's obviously the right thing to do. There's a great Fitzgerald story that I like called The Four Fists. And at the end of it, the guy is sort of put in this difficult, unethical business proposition. He ends up sort of telling the person across from the truth instead of, you know, sort of this shark-like business deal. And he goes, it's obviously the right thing to do, but when you've got a wife and kids, that sort of righteousness can also feel like selfishness, right? Like, I think about Rutilius Rufus, right? He's sort of brought up on these false charges, and he just doesn't bother to defend himself because he feels like doing that is beneath him. I'm now getting off on a little bit of a tangent, but, you know, he doesn't. So he ends up being tried, convicted, and sent away. And on the one hand, that's very brave and bold, but, you know, I'm sure his family was probably a little bit like, Dad, why didn't you just, you know, like, bother to defend yourself? And Musonius Rufus, doesn't he push back? He goes, like, I will fight.
He makes fun of, this is sort of going back to Socrates too, right? Mm-hmm. He's like, you know, hey, I'm going to make a defense of myself.
Yeah.
You could count on a Stoic making a very strenuous defense for themselves. You know, it's funny that another related story in Epictetus. It's interesting when you read Epictetus, like in Marcus, you can find all the four virtues listed, right, in his writings. But Epictetus never lays them all out, like in a list. Oh. But and courage is the one that's usually missing from his list. But he tells all these great stories. And in fact, there's one story that Epictetus tells twice in Arrian's, you know, collection of his lectures, in book 1, chapter 6, and in book 2, chapter 16. He's talking about how all these terrible things befall us, and we just sit around crying, oh, my nose is running, my nose is running. And, you know, in both places, he's like, hey, what's up with you? You know, don't you have a pair of hands? Blow your nose.
Right.
But in both cases, he lists, and again, this goes back to these resources that we have, you know, that are built in. In both places, he's like, you know, hasn't God given you endurance, magnanimity, courage? He lists them, though, in both places, in all of those things, endurance, magnanimity, courage, they all fall under the Stoic idea of courage. And that's why I think Epictetus loved to tell the story of Helvidius Priscus.
And Agrippinus, too. I think those are two of his heroes.
Who stood up, you know, in Helvidius's case, to Vespasian, right? Mm-hmm. Threat of death. So he, you know, he may not have always listed courage, but he loved to tell. In fact, he would say to his students all the time, yeah, you're lions in the classroom, but you're foxes when you get out there in the world.
Right.
You turn your tail and you run.
No, and you think about what courage would mean for someone like Epictetus, who's a slave. I mean, like, courage is having your leg broken. Courage is being executed and or being exiled with sort of not a thought. I mean, he's riding the razor's edge. He's not living the sort of posh life of Seneca or even Cato.
Yeah, that's true.
So one thing, this is, again, a sort of a minor courage moment, but one of the things I was really conscious of on the launch of the book, and I know, I think people somewhat enjoy the inside baseball, but the decision, obviously deciding to open a bookstore was one of the crazier things that I've done in the last couple of years. And you know what's funny? I don't know if I told you this, but when I have an idea for something I want to do, I usually, because I get excited about it, I usually look for disconfirmation. So I call people who are liable to convince me that it's a bad idea. Now, you told me it was a good idea because you love bookstores and you used to have a bookstore. But I was talking to my wife about it, and I was like, who will tell me this is a very bad idea and why I shouldn't do it? And so I was like, you know what? I'm going to call Tim. I'm going to call Tim Ferriss. Tim, the sort of outsourcer, avoid entanglements. Assets that sort of cost time and money. I was like, Tim will tell me this is a bad idea. And Tim was like, how will you know if you don't want a bookstore? Or he's like, how will you know if you really want a bookstore if you don't try one? And how will you know that you don't want a bookstore if you haven't tried one? And he was one of the few people that gave me the permission to do it.
That's cool. I love it.
But as part of that, this is the sort of first book launch that I've had while the store exists. And so early on, sort of strategically in the launch, I decided, you know, instead of routing these orders to these different vendors, instead of outsourcing the customer relationship to Amazon, to Barnes & Noble, to Audible, to, you know, these big retailers, I was like, I'm going to do it directly. Like, I'm going to sell the book directly, which I had a little experimentation with The Boy Who Would Be King and the leather-bound editions of the two books, but nothing at the scale of this book. And I just thought it was interesting. I anticipated it because it's happened I've seen hints of it. But I thought we should talk about just how much of a surprise this was to people in publishing. Because not because they thought I wouldn't sell as many copies, not just because they thought it would be a lot of work, but did it not seem like one of the big objections and concerns was that this would affect my position on a bestseller list?
Oh yeah, I mean completely. You know, it's all a the various lists have various methodologies, and they're sort of tried and true. And it's a certain mix of accounts that report in different ways, and it gets compiled, and that's how you know who's on the list in the various categories. And once you start, you know, talking about you know, a startup bookstore that is barely on, you know, anyone's radar, becoming, you know, in essence, like one of the largest channels of distribution for the book, it's like, well, that's gonna spell disaster, because the list keepers won't have you on their radar.
It's funny, like it struck me as a connection to one of my favorite Marcus Aurelius quotes, which I remember really hitting me for the first time when The Obstacle Is the Way came out, sold enough copies to hit more than one bestseller list, but mysteriously did not appear. And I remember, you know, turning to and drawing some value from the quote where Marcus Aurelius says, you know, we care about ourselves more than other people, but then we care about their opinion more than our own. Like, even though an author is paid not on how they do on the bestseller list, but paid based on how many copies they sold. And the whole point of writing a book is to reach more people, or to as many people as possible. The irony that even people in publishing, to say nothing of authors, value the New York Times, which is admittedly not an objective list. We value whether the New York Times says you're a bestseller or not.
Right.
Even if that came at the expense of selling better. It's a hilarious, weird thing we back ourselves into.
You know, it's funny because, you know, people know inside publishing that often a book is on the list and it really hasn't done that well.
Yeah.
Or, you know, or it was a 1 week wonder or whatever. But I do remember distinctly, you know, I had a fairly long career at HarperCollins. Rupert Murdoch didn't want to hear about the New York Times bestseller list because he knew a lot of those books weren't selling.
Interesting. So. Yeah, and to me, they're like the tricky part about it, and it's not, again, not the courage of you know, airlifting people out of Afghanistan, but it's easier to measure yourself against external metrics, right? It's easy to go, oh, the New York Times said I was a success, therefore I'm a success. It's harder to stick with what Marcus is saying, which is to value your own opinion more than these external things because you control it. But to go, I think there was a feeling as I embarked on, you know, this approach was like, hey, I'm going to kind of burn the boats behind me. I'm not going to value these sort of easy, straightforward benchmarks. I'm going to have to measure what success is to myself. And I'm going to have to bet on myself long-term at the expense of short-term validation or recognition.
Yep. Well, it certainly requires great resources to do what you're doing, especially when you have four pallets of books show up without a forklift to unload them. But, you know, there is an aspect of the virtue of courage, which the Stoics prized above all, and it was philoponia, the love of toil, the love of work, or industriousness, as the translators sometimes refer to it. And, you know, they believed that it was a knowledge of, you know, how to accomplish what is proposed without being prevented by the toil. And I know you and your team are certainly right up against that wall right now.
Yeah. So. No, it's been a grind. And then, yeah, it may be that even though I would sell enough copies to debut at number one, like Stillness did, I may not only not do that, I may not appear on the list at all. But you have to me, I know I'm making a bet on, one, the direct connection to the audience. I know that it's actually increasing the sales. I know that it's, I'm also getting to, you know, sort of hand sign the copies to the most loyal fans, which is my, you know, something I feel really honored to be able to do. And it's an investment, again, in the rest of the series, because now instead of Amazon being able to say, hey, there's a new book out, I'll be able to say that directly.
Yeah. And people really want to support The Painted Porch.
Yes, which is incredibly overwhelming, both literally and figuratively and emotionally.
Exactly.
But the consequence of all that, and there are no decisions that don't have consequences, that they're not trade-offs, is like, hey, people will be like, did he fall off? You know, like, why are your books selling worse? And so you have to be willing to judge yourself by your own standards, the inner scorecard versus that external scorecard. And it's not without its consequences.
Yeah.
Anything else we should say about the book, Steve?
Well, the idea of courage? I just really want to do everything I can to help get the word out about it. I've got copies here that I'm getting ready to send out. I know all your books are being shipped, but I think there's so much here for people to dig into. And from the very first pages of the book, where you talk about Hercules at the crossroads, and how his story is really the story that each of us is facing every day, I think this is going to resonate for people. And it's, again, I think starting with courage was the right place to start. It's the very thing that we all need now, as we're getting a gradual reopening to a very broken world. We all need some more courage.
Oh, that last thing I was going to say, because I've been actively working on it, especially now on the self-discipline book. You know that putting out books is frustrating. Working with publishers is always frustrating. Working with people is frustrating, but publishing has always been that way in the middle of a pandemic. Am I doing better at being calmer and less, let's say, keeping my temper in check? I feel like I am, but I'll take some radical candor from you. Am I doing better this go around? I'd like to think that as each book gets out, I'm a little bit less a bundle of nerves, but I know I remain still.
Given all the obstacles of the last 2 weeks, and spending more than a few days nauseous myself, I think you're doing great.
All right, I'll take it. I'm trying. I do try to get less attached to the external results with each book, and I try to anticipate all the things that could go wrong with each book. I think the tension is always, how as a Stoic do you focus on what you control, not taking things personally, you know, understanding that things go wrong, and, you know, hold people accountable and expect both competence and accountability from people who have different assignments and jobs. You know, that's the tension.
You have to surface the urgency when it's required. And if you don't, things will not be completed. But I know that you did a fair amount of meditating this week. And again, it's back to the William James that you quote in the book. You know, we're all working on making our nervous system our ally instead of just one more enemy.
That's right. And trying not to do things that don't age well and tantrums or knockdown, drag out fights don't age well.
No, that's for sure.
Steve, you're the best. We'll sell some more books together. By that, I mean more projects. And I really appreciate you helping me make this one a reality.
Thanks, Ryan. It's been my privilege. And go.
All right.
It's going to be a great week.
Remember, Courage is Calling, Fortune Favors the Brave is now available everywhere. You can go to your local bookstore and pick it up. You can come to The Painted Porch and pick it up. We are still offering the pre-order bonuses. We've extended it to the end of this week. So you can get that at dailystoic.com/pre-order. But you can also get Audible. You can get eBooks. You can get whatever you want from wherever you want it. But I would very much like you to support the new book, Courage is Calling, Fortune Favors the Brave. Hey, Prime members, you can listen to The Daily Stoic early and ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen early and ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts.
You know, if I would have applied myself, I could have gone to the NBA.
You think so?
Yeah, I think so. But it's just like, it's been done. You know, I didn't want to, I was like, I don't want to be a follower. Hi, I'm Jason Concepcion.
And I'm Shea Serrano. And we are back. We have a new podcast from Wondery. It's called Six Trophies.
Woo!
And it's the f***ing best.
Each week, Shea Serrano and I are combing through all the NBA storylines, finding the best, most interesting, most compelling stories, and then handing out six pop culture themed trophies for six basketball related activities.
Trophies like the Dominic Toretto, I Live My Life a Quarter Mile at a Time trophy, which is given to someone who made a short-term decision with no regard for future consequence.
Or the Christopher Nolan Tenet trophy, which is given to someone who did something that we didn't understand.
Catalina Wine Mixer trophy.
Ooh, the Lauryn Hill, you might win some, but you just lost one trophy. And what's more, the NBA playoffs are here, so you want to make Six Trophies your go-to companion podcast through all the craziness. Follow Six Trophies on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. Listen ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus.
Guy Raz's How I Built This is a podcast where each week he talks to the founders behind the world's biggest companies to learn the real stories of how they built them. In each episode, you hear these entrepreneurs really go into their story. And Guy is an incredible interviewer. He doesn't just dance around the surface. He asks real questions because he himself is an entrepreneur. He's built this huge show and this huge company. In a recent episode, they talked to the founder of Liquid Death, that crazy water company that's become this billion-dollar brand. Follow the show on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to How I Built This early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts. And for a deep dive in daily business content, listen to Wondery Destination for Business podcasts with shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, The Best One Yet, Business Movers, and many more. Wondery means business.